Hello, welcome everybody to this week's sutta class. Maybe some of you are looking at me and thinking, has Ajahn Brahm lost a lot of weight and a new pair of glasses? No, unfortunately not. I am replacing Ajahn Brahm today in doing this class because he had to catch an early flight to Indonesia. And most other senior monks in the monastery are also traveling or otherwise have some other duties to do. So this is the first time that I get to sit here in this spot, which means a lot to me to be sitting here. And already when I've been sitting here next to Ajahn Brahm or another senior monk, it felt really special to me because I remember being maybe 15 years ago or about that, being on the other side of the camera that's hanging there, or maybe they're using that camera right now, looking at this stream from the internet from the Netherlands on the other side of the world. And now I'm sitting here, it feels nice but special. Yeah, it's so I'm really grateful for everybody who has come here and who is happy to look at some of the Buddha's words with me. And also welcome everybody on the internet as well. I'm very happy that you're watching as well. And this is also my first like big teaching gig, you could say. So if anybody, I don't know how it's gonna end up, what I'm gonna say, I'll just let the words come out. But if anybody is getting really bored halfway through, then I won't feel offended if you just wave goodbye, and I'll may wave back, and then you can go out. But if you're happy to stay with me, then we'll go until about, I think the normal time is we stop at 4 or something like that, but we'll see. It was hard to decide how much text to prepare, so we'll see. I won't go for too long, but... So about some of the suttas that I prepared, I had to put it together in a little bit of a rush, so there may be some mistakes and all, but hopefully we'll find those. For those who are online, you can find these texts as well on the website docdroid.net/THE29JY. So docdroid.net, that's docdroid.net/THE29JY. I don't know how long these files will be on that website, but they are at least for now. I'm just hearing here that there should be a link in the chat of YouTube. So have a look at that. Anyway, I decided to make a little compilations of suttas on the topic of Nibbana. And you may be thinking, now this is your first teaching thing. Why do you start straight away with the subject of Nibbana? It is like supposed to be like the highest aim, yeah. And also, why should we listen to you? Well, that's up for you to decide why you should listen to me. But I can give you a little bit of background. I've been teaching the Pali in the monastery, Bodhinyana Monastery, for the last 5 years, and in those years I've read a lot of suttas in Pali, and in reading Pali you see sometimes things that in translations may not be so obvious, and partly for that reason I really like reading the suttas in Pali, also because it makes me feel really connected with the Buddha's teaching. When you read translations of suttas, it's always you see those texts through somebody's interpretation. So that's always like filtered through a lens, as it were. I've also made some translations of my own here. And those are also just, they're also filtered. Yeah, no translation is perfect. But I thought I'd start teaching on Nibbana because this is the aim that we are Buddhists for, or at least why I became a monk. So it makes sense to me to start the teachings with the aim, yeah, where you're aiming for. Then you know what to do already. You know a lot about that as well, because it's like if you know where to go, then you know where you should walk, which direction. So that's why I like to talk on this, and also just because it's a little bit, I just picked a topic basically. Anyway, as I've said, I've made some of my own translations. This is not because I think existing translations are terrible or bad, but I picked a couple of suttas that I liked. I didn't find any translator who had translated these all, so if I would have put together translations of different translators, then sometimes certain words are translated in different ways by different people, and I would have to constantly comment, oh, this word means that. I will be doing that anyway, but I thought it would make more of a cohesive sense if there would just be one single translation or one single approach to the translations anyway. So that happens to be mine. But I might comment, if you have any questions you think of other translations, then feel free to ask. And any other question during this talk, just raise your hand, and then I'll get to you. Also, I like to look at different translations because it puts these texts in a different light. Every translator has their own little slant on things. And what I find with reading Pali, that it's impossible, as I said before, to make a perfect translation. Yeah, so because every translator approaches things from a slightly different angle, by reading multiple translations, you can put all these interpretations together if you don't know Pali and get your own feeling for what the underlying text, what the actual meaning is. But maybe we start with the actual text now. So the first text is some verses from the Dhammapada, the verses 202 and 203. And these are on the topic of Nibbana. So I won't read out the Pali, because I don't think most of us here would benefit much from that. But I put it there. I always like to have this reminder of what the actual Pali is, as I said before, to bring me back to the Buddha's words. Yeah? Sometimes you can get a bit lost in translation, as it were. You just get too much influenced by certain translations, so I always like this reminder of having the Pali there. And also, I can look up some words if you have any questions about them. So I'll start reading out my own translations and skip the Pali. So are we there on the screen? There is no fire like desire, no fault like anger, no pain like the components of existence, no higher ease than peace. Hunger is the worst illness, what is created the worst pain. If you know this as it really is, extinguishment is the highest ease. One thing about Pali verse is that it contains a lot of imagery and a lot of symbolism, sometimes very densely a lot of symbolism can follow one after another, and often these verses are hard to interpret without having a more wider understanding of the Buddha's teachings. But I assume that many of you here, I've seen all your faces before, and I think most of us here have a wider understanding of the Buddha's teaching. So that's why we have already some context for all these verses. But it's sometimes people take verses, and I've seen this happen, they take it out of context and they take one line of verse and interpret it in a certain way, and then in the light of that certain verse, they interpret the whole rest of the Pali canon. Sometimes happens like that, but that is not, in my opinion, not the best way to approach things. It's better to go the other way around. So for that reason, I've also added some other texts that will come later. But to get back to this verse, there is no fire like desire. Does this remind anybody of a famous sutta by the Buddha? Yeah, I see people nodding. So, the fire sermon somebody mentions here. That's what it reminded me of as well. So, in the fire sermon, the Buddha explains how he says everything is on fire. Sabbang Adhitang is the first phrase of that sutta, which means everything is on fire. Of course, he doesn't mean literally everything is on fire. It's a symbolism, as I said. There's a lot of symbolism in the Buddha's teachings, especially in verse. And we can use this kind of symbolism. It's not always that these symbolisms are merely descriptive. They can also be used. So, for example, a sentence like this, there is no fire like desire. I can sometimes use it in my meditation. I feel desires coming up in my mind when I'm meditating. You've all probably experienced that as well. And then, how does that feel? Yeah. Often we just don't think about how desires feel, because they are, in my experience, they can be so tempting to follow up on them that we don't look at them themselves, or we don't look at the effects that they can have on our mind. But if you really look at it, then sometimes desire can really feel like it's burning in your mind. It's really something strong, not nice. It's really it's like consuming you. Yeah, like fire consumes things. In a sense, desire does the same thing. So here the Buddha is comparing desire to a fire. There is no fault like anger. So the word for fault here is a little bit hard to translate. It means literally something like a wrong throw of a dice. You throw a dice and you get snake eyes or something. Yeah, that the word is here kali. I've translated it as fault, which is a common translation, but there's a little bit more behind it. But the idea is anger. Yeah, it's also something that we don't want to pursue. And there's no pain like the components of existence. Those who've been here before have heard the phrase components of existence before. That stands for the khandhas, often translated as aggregates. And I've borrowed that translation from Ajahn Brahm. He has been using that recently. And I think it's quite nice, so I've put it in here as well. So, no pain. The word for pain is what you will have heard a lot of time before, is the word dukkha, which is translated often as suffering. But it literally also, it means literal, like physical pain. So I like to look at it like that and translate it like that, because to me, the word suffering, I don't know about you, but to me, suffering can sometimes feel a bit abstract. It's like, suffering, what exactly, how does that apply to me? But if I read about pain, yeah, pain I can really relate to. It's like a physical feeling, yeah. So the question here is a literal translation of dukkha, things which are hard to bear. That's probably trying to find too much into the word. It's like splitting it up into do and ka. I'm not sure if that is necessary to do. But if you look at the context, how the word dukkha is used, it's literally used for painful feelings in the body. And it also means suffering, but I like to give it a little bit of a different slant here and translate it as pain. So when we read the phrase, no pain like the components of existence, this is almost a summary of the first noble truth of the Buddha, the truth about dukkha. And then the last phrase of this first verse, there is no higher ease, that's sukha, than peace. So that would be, which noble truth would that be? Relate to? That would be the third noble truth of moving beyond suffering. So see how this verse contains a lot already. Moving on to hunger is the worst illness. What created the worst pain? This is like repeating parts of the previous verse, because hunger is often a synonym in the Buddha's text for desire as well. Yeah. So we've seen before that fire can be a synonym for desire, and here we have also hunger as a synonym for desire. And what's created is the worst pain or the worst suffering. And what's created, the word is sankhara, and that word is discussed a lot because it can be a little bit difficult to translate. It can mean, as you've seen in Ajahn Brahm's classes, it can mean the will, but it can also mean things that are created by the will. And what I mean by that is the process of rebirth, our existence is created, according to the second noble truth, by our desire to be. Yeah. So when we pass away and we still have some desire to exist, then that energy will carry on and create a next life, a new rebirth. And for that, the Buddha uses the word sankhara also. So here, what is created is the worst pain. It's, if you compare it to the verse above, then what is created, the sankhara, is a synonym for the components of existence, for the khanda, because it's almost the same phrase here, you see. No pain like the components of existence. What's created, the worst pain. So these two, sankhara and the five khandas, are often used interchangeably throughout the text, and here we have a very clear example of this. If you know this as it really is, extinguishment is the highest ease. That last sentence is Nibbhanang Paramang Sukhang. Ajahn Brahm likes to say that phrase a lot. At least, I don't know if he does here, but in the teachings in Bodhiyana Monastery, he very often quotes this phrase. So what I translated as extinguishment, that is the word Nibbana. So we've seen before already this analogy to fires, and it happens in a lot of suttas, these analogies to fires. And fire burns, it's not nice, and the opposite of when a fire goes down, that is called Nibbana. Of that fire, it's called the extinguishment of a fire. And I've got some more texts about Nibbana, about extinguishment, but I thought this was some nice, relatively simple verses to introduce why would we even strive for Nibbana. In these verses we get this idea of, you know, all this desire, all this anger, and all this suffering, this dukkha in our lives. How do we get rid of it? The Buddha's answer is a bit more complicated than this, of course, but it's basically to find the highest ease, the paramang sukhang, the highest happiness, you could translate it as. And that is extinguishment, the Nibbana. But what is interesting about this verse is that before it says extinguishment is the highest ease, it says, if you know this as it really is. Yeah. The Buddha says that here because it's not easy to understand Nibbana, and it's not easy to see how to get out of rebirth. How can this be happiness? How can this be the highest ease? Because often people may say that if we get reborn again, oh, that's nice. I can have another life. I can have another go at it. I may exist forever, maybe reborn in even happier places. Yeah, maybe reborn in heaven realms. And on the surface, that sounds all really nice. But the Buddha's here saying, if you know all this as it really is, if you know samsara as it really is, then you will understand that the extinguishment, the nibbana of all that, is the highest ease, the highest happiness. So even in this little verse, we already also have a reference to insight, to the importance of insight. Yeah. It's not easy to understand the Buddha's teachings, and especially those on Nibbana can be hard to understand. I've seen somebody raise their hand here. Just to repeat it for the internet, the question is about hunger. If it's implied that the more you feed hunger, the worse it gets, yeah? And about physical hunger, I don't think this is about physical hunger so much. It's more about the hunger of the mind, yeah? The desire of the mind. And I think, yes, the more you... the more you feed it, the more you will be insatiated, as it were, like be unsatisfied with things. Right? It's always, the mind is always moving on to the next thing. You have a craving for something, and you may fulfill that craving for a while. Maybe have a desire to watch some movie or have some certain food. And then you can fulfill that craving for a while, but then afterwards, in my experience, the mind gets back on you, as it were, with even stronger craving for the next time. And this is maybe why people get into addictions. You know, they just can't get enough. They always need the next rush, the next thing. So, yeah, that's a good point I think you've made.
Is that also saying the hunger for knowledge is the worst illness?
No, I don't think that is included. I think it only means here, like the kind of desires which are not helpful, which are unwholesome for the Buddhist path, yeah. So there are wholesome desires and wants as well, like the desire to find peace, for example. That's a very useful desire, and that wouldn't be included in under hunger here, yeah. Any more questions about these two verses? If not, then I'll move on to the next text, which is from the Itivutaka. The Itivutaka is a part of the what is called the minor discourses of the Buddha, the Kudaka Nikaya. So we have the famous the collections of texts, the Digha Nikaya, the Majjhima Nikaya, Samyutta Nikaya, and Anguttara Nikaya. But then there's a fifth one, which is a little bit lesser known, which is the Kudaka Nikaya, and that Kudaka Nikaya has all, the Dhammapada, for example, comes from there as well. It has all these little books on, little collections of texts, and the Itivutaka is one of them, which is often considered also part of the early texts. So, to read it out, what it says here, or at least what it says in my translation. There are two kinds of extinguishment. What are those two? The kind of extinguishment which leaves a remnant, and the kind of extinguishment which leaves no remnant. It's an interesting text here, because this is not the only place where the Buddha says this, but this is the clearest place where he says that by extinguishment, by nibbana, he's not just referring to one thing. When he uses that term, he may refer to either one of two things. And so when people may ask you, maybe after this class, somebody on the street walks up to you and asks, what is nibbana? And then you say, well, there's actually, I could answer that question in two different ways. Yeah, there's two ways that the Buddha talks about nibbana. I find that this is very, very often overlooked, actually. A lot of books that I've seen in the library in Bodhinyana and in other places, they may talk about nibbana, but often they only discuss one of these two. So what are these two? The Buddha explains it in detail in the rest of this sutta. What is the kind of extinguishment which leaves a remnant? Then you are enlightened. You have no defilements, are finished, have done the work, laid down the burden, reached the goal. You fully removed what tied you to existence and are fully liberated by having perfect wisdom. So this is saying you've done the Buddha's teachings. Yeah, you are an arahant, as they call it. But then it continues, but your five senses remain, through which you still experience, and it says experiences here, it should just be, you still experience agreeable and disagreeable things and feel pleasure and pain. The ending of desire, anger, and delusion, that is the kind of extinguishment which leaves a remnant. So this is the first kind of extinguishment, which is the ending of the defilements of the mind, the anger and the craving, the desire and the delusions in the mind. And Ajahn Brahm will, or in other monks have talked about these subtopics for many years, so I won't go into too much detail of what that all entails. But this is the first nibbana. It's basically when you become enlightened, that is called nibbana. Yeah? When the mind is free from this fire of desire, then this fire of desire, these fires of anger and of delusion, they get extinguished, the nibbana. This is why this is called nibbana. And why is it called the kind of extinguishment, the kind of nibbana which leaves a remnant? This is because this enlightened person is still alive, and as it says before, still experiences agreeable and disagreeable things, and still feels pleasure and pain. The word for pain here again is dukkha. This may come as a shock to some people, but it says here literally that enlightened beings, they still experience suffering. Yeah? They still feel pleasure as well, but they also feel pain, the dukkha. Why is this? Because life is intrinsically suffering. Even for enlightened beings, they still experience pains in the body, and that's the main suffering they experience, but they are not fully beyond suffering yet. So what would be the second kind of nibbana, the second extinguishment? Does anybody have an idea on that? Sorry, yeah, Ananda. Yeah, this is Ananda has you right. When the enlightened being, when they pass away, then that is also called nibbana. This is the second Nibbana, the kind of extinguishment which leaves no remnant. And what is the kind of extinguishment which leaves no remnant? I'm reading out from my translation again. Then you are enlightened, you have no defilements, you are finished, have done the work, laid down the burden, reached the goal. You fully remove what tied you to existence and are fully liberated by having perfect wisdom. This is a repetition of before, basically saying you need to be enlightened first. And all that is experienced by you in this life, not being enjoyed because you don't desire it anymore, cools off. That is the second extinguishment. That is the kind of extinguishment which leaves no remnant. It's not said very clearly here about passing away, but in the verses below it is clearer. Yeah, and also some other texts that I've included, it will become clearer that what it refers to here is when the enlightened being passes away, then they attain the highest kind of Nibbana, the highest peace. That is when it all cools off, is how I translated it here. The Pali is Siddhi Bhavisanti. It's another one of these. I can't think of a better word, but symbolic kind of words, because it has this kind of cooling off idea again. It's also again referring to these ideas of fire and extinguishment. Yes. I think a microphone is coming. Let's wait for that for a moment.
Bhante, that in the first one, where there are remnants left in the extinguishment, that is that the an arahant, though they feel the dukkha, the pain, is that more of bodily pain than less of mental pain? Though they feel the bodily pain, physical pain, they don't allow that to infiltrate into their mind?
Yes, but...
Would that be...
Yeah, that is in a sense true, but also remember what the Buddha said before. There's no pain like the components of existence. That was in the first verse that I read out. Yeah, the enlightened being is still composed, as it were, of these khandhas, of these aggregates. So they are still all these khandhas. They don't suddenly change into non-suffering when you become enlightened. They are still suffering. Yeah. It's said that the highest dwellings or the highest abidings of the enlightened beings is the jhanas and other deeper meditation states. But in some of the texts that Buddha also said, yeah, those are also still suffering. Yeah. So an arahant is not just suffering bodily, but still also mentally. But they are so close to overcoming that, and they don't have any anger or desire, that suffering doesn't really count towards. Compared to suffering that other beings may experience, yeah. So let me read further, and there are some more verses here, and often in suttas, the verses, they summarize what has been said before. I've sort of touched on this already earlier. And this is a good example of how this happens, how the verses basically say the same thing as the what they call the prose, Pali, the just spoken words, but in a more poetic way. Yeah? It's often difficult to see in English translations how poetic these verses can be, but in Pali they are really structured after certain what they call meters or rhythms. The Pali really follows a pattern in the way these verses are constructed. There are two kinds of extinguishment, made known by the one with insight. Such a one, not supported by anything. One kind happens here in the present life. The watering of existence is ended, but it leaves a remnant. But leaving no remnant after this life is where existence completely ceases. So there are two kinds of extinguishment, made known by the one with insight. And the one with insight, that is the Buddha, of course. Such a one, there's a sort of like an honorific term, as it were. That doesn't carry much meaning. The Pali here is tadhina, which means as such. So what it means by such a one is an enlightened one. Yeah. Not supported by anything means it could also be translated not needing anything, yeah? No desire anymore, nothing that keeps him in samsara, keeps him supported in the process of rebirth. One kind happens here in the present life when you get enlightened. The watering of existence is ended. This is another thing which I found a little bit hard to translate, and most translators struggle with putting this this word that I translated as watering. They struggle with that. Bhikkhu Bodhi, I believe, translated the conduit of existence, but that doesn't mean anything to me anyway, the conduit of existence. I don't know what that means, but watering of existence I've got here. The Pali word is, what was it that? Neti is what it's watering. Neti literally means a canal where water flows through. Yeah, nurturing would be, sorry, the microphone arrived too late, yeah.
Does it mean nurturing?
Nurturing, yeah, that's how you could that's a good explanation of what it means, yeah. It literally means something like what leads water to something, yeah. It's like as I said before, like a canal. So what it means is if you cut off the water to something, it can't grow anymore. So if you cut off the water going to the process of rebirth, to existence, then it's a synonym for craving, basically. And if you cut that off, you won't be reborn anymore. It says it here in a bit of a flowery language, as I said before, the verses can be very symbolic. So we don't have to find too much meaning in some of these words, but yeah. The watering of existence is ended, but it leaves a remnant, as we've seen before, the remnant being still being alive, still experiencing things through the senses, still experiencing pleasure and pain, happiness and suffering. But, and this is the good news, leaving no remnant after this life of the Arhant is where existence completely ceases. So this is where suffering, existence is suffering. It's always such a drag, so basically. Can be. This is where, after the enlightened being passes away, this is where existence completely ceases. So this is the second kind of nirvana. So the sutta talking about the two kinds of nirvana, If we remember this, that there's two kinds, then we can, when we read other suttas, we can use this information to figure out which kind of nibbana the Buddha is talking about in different texts. Because, as I said before, this is only one of the very few places where he specifically mentioned teaching two kinds of nibbana. But most of the time he doesn't mention this, he just mentions nibbana. Yeah. And then sometimes he's referring to this first kind of nibbana, actually. This is the one that is most often refers to. It's the enlightenment nibbana, when the desire, anger, and delusion, when those go out, when those extinguish. This is the first kind of nibbana. But in other suttas he may be referring to the kind of nibbana, when an enlightened being, when their existence ends. And this is, for example, in the Parinibbana Sutta, when the Buddha himself passes away, is a good example of this.
Yes, Venerable, did the Buddha go through this himself as well? Like, towards the end, he was suffering with bodily pains and the stomach and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And then at his final nirvana, that was the, that was when there were no remnants left. So.
Yeah, this is a good point that you bring up, actually. That the Buddha himself even said that he was still suffering, yeah. Even though he was fully enlightened, he was still also had suffering. And it's quite regular, quite often overlooked actually. So thank you for bringing that up, because often you hear, if you don't crave anymore, you don't suffer anymore. But when we read these kind of texts, it's quite clear that it's not. Well, most of the suffering is gone when you don't crave anymore, but there's more suffering to be removed. Yeah? Thanks for that. Any other questions about this this text?
It seems that enlightened beings get all their growth karma at the end, doesn't it? Because what was it, Mangalana, he was sort of like killed by murderers because of his past karma. And someone said, I did hear it say that Ajahn Chah had his physical problems because he was a Chinese general many lifetimes ago. Can you add to that?
Okay, yeah. I don't have any particular opinion on whether those kind of stories are true. I have never met either of those monks, so and I can't look into their past lives anyway. The Buddha said at some point the karma and its results are, if you think about it too much, you go crazy. That's basically what he said. It's impossible to know. So maybe those kind of things are due to karma. Maybe not. Maybe some things are just random. You get sick just because you're born. Basically, maybe that's why Ajahn Chah got sick. Or maybe because he worked so hard. Could be. But it could be past life things as well. I can't say. I don't want to don't want to make any definite statement about that. Yeah.
I was just thinking that it's interesting that the Buddha became enlightened and then remained alive a long time. And you wonder what would cause him to keep going if he's not attached and he isn't nurturing his existence and he hasn't got any reason to continue, really.
Yeah, but maybe he did have a reason to continue, which was to teach others the way out. I think this is why the Buddha kept going, why he taught so much. It wasn't anything to do with himself anymore. Yeah. But for others, he stayed alive for others. There's also a text where the Buddha says, well, I'm going on a 2 weeks retreat now. And then you may think, okay, that's just for his own peace of mind. But he says, for the compassion of future people. Yeah? So he goes on retreat, not for himself, but out of compassion, to show others what should be done and what is possible. So this is why he stayed alive for such a long time.
So that's a remnant, isn't it?
That would be included under the what you would call the remnant. But it's not fueled by desire anymore. It's basically still going on. Because he was born, he stayed alive until the end of his life. It's not that when you're enlightened, you suddenly die at the same moment. You still have your body that keeps you going, your vital energy that keeps you moving on. Yeah. Does that answer your question?
Do you think it's good karma and that it has to be used up? that keeps people alive when they really don't need to stay alive?
Yeah, this is another question about karma, which is, I think, maybe a little bit too detailed about karma, beyond my knowledge anyway. Yeah, maybe sometimes it keeps, it's with karma what keeps people alive, but I think usually it's, it's just being born and your body stays alive, so it's nothing particular to do with karma. The Buddha, you could say, was beyond karma, so. And other enlightened beings, so it wasn't karma anymore. Yeah.
Yeah. You must have hit a good spot. So many questions. Do you think the Buddha chose to have the pain with his stomach? Do you think if he wanted to, he could meditate the pain away? But he chose not to.
I'm pretty convinced if he wanted to, he could. Go into a deep meditation and don't feel that pain anymore. Actually, he says it at some point, the only moment I feel at peace is when I'm in the deep meditations. But when he's in the deep meditation, he can't teach at the same moment because they are so deep, you can't really think or talk anymore at those kind of these deep meditations. You're fully removed from the body. That's why you don't feel it anymore. But you're so far removed that it also doesn't give you the opportunity to share. They didn't give the Buddha the opportunity to share his teachings with the world. So yeah, that's why I think he still needed to come out of those meditations and still sometimes feel that pain. But he wouldn't be really affected by it mentally anyway, because he was beyond those kind of reactions as an enlightened being. It's already a 3:45. I think it's only like 14 minutes left, so I've still got quite a few suttas. I think I've chewed off more, I've bitten off more than I can chew, but who knows, maybe I'll have to come back another time, but we can do a little bit more. I would like to, maybe I pick up the pace a bit so we can maybe still do it all. The next Sutta, it's verses again. I like verses, as you may have noticed, because they summarize things so well often. And I have all these imageries which you can use in your own practice. So the next one is from the Theragatha, which is a collection of texts of the monks from the Buddha's time. There's also a Tarigatha, which is verses from the nuns, from the bhikkhunis. They contain some very interesting statements which you don't find in other places. This one is quite interesting. It is also about these two kinds of nibbana, but using more imagery again. It's sort of not saying it as directly as the previous text, but it's still referring to the same idea. So this was spoken by the Venerable Udayi. A big roaring fire dies down when it has no more fuel. We see all these fire images again. And when the embers have gone cold, one calls it extinguished. This simile was taught by the aware to convey a meaning. Great giants will recognize what a giant was taught by a giant. And the word for giant here is naga. I'll come back to it later. With no desire, no anger, no delusions, and no defilements, being enlightened basically, on giving up the body, an undefiled giant will fully go out. We'll get the words for fully go out here are nibbuto, parinibbuto. It's almost the same word as nibbana. So we'll get fully extinguished is how you could translate it as well. So get back to the beginning of this. A big fire dies down when it has no more fuel. What this is referring to is the first nibbana that we've seen before. The nibbana when the fire of desire and hatred and delusion, when that dies down, when it has no more fuel. The word for fuel is here is ahara. When you don't fuel those emotions anymore, then those defilements, they die down. when a fire dies down, it still remains the embers, the glowing embers. They are still hot as well. And these embers, they refer to what was previously called the remnant, what still remains of an enlightened being. When these embers have gone cold, one calls it extinguished. That is when this is the second type of nibbana. This simile was taught by the aware, by the Buddha, basically to convey a meaning. Great giants will recognize, great nagas will realize what a giant was taught by a giant. Here, Udaya is referring to himself. He's basically saying, what I was taught by the Buddha, others can realize this as well. And the word naga, translated here as giant, it means some kind of big, sometimes it means a big elephant. Yeah. But I think I copied this from Ajahn Sujata's translations, and he had giants, which works well. Gets the meaning anyway. With no desire, no anger, no delusion, and no defilement, so being enlightened, on giving up the body, the undefiled giant will fully go out, will have this second kind of nibbana. So we see here a reference to these two kinds of nibbana as well. It's easy to overlook sometimes in verses like these. You just read them and because they are sometimes not as direct. You can easily miss those kind of subtle points, but quite nice verses. I like these. Any questions about those? So the next sutta is also on the subject of nibbana. It again has all this imagery of heat and fire as well, which nibbana is all about extinguishing these fires. But it uses it in a slightly different way. And I like it especially because of the last statement that we will come back to later. Imagine a man takes a pot out of a potter's oven and places it on a flat piece of ground. The heat dissipates right then, and only pot shards, a broken pot, will be left over. So too, as an arahant, as an enlightened being, you understand that after your body breaks down, when life ends, all that is experienced, not being delighted in, cools off right then, and only bodily remains will be left. You have a little throwback here to one of the suttas we've seen before. All that is experienced, not being delighted in, not being enjoyed, I've had before, because they don't crave for those things anymore. It cools off. Siti, Bhavisanti. So here, what the Buddha is doing here is comparing the body to a pot, basically. Yeah. And then when the enlightened being dies down, only bodily remains will be left, just like this pot that has cooled off will only have the pot shards will be left there, the pieces of the broken pot. And when I read Buddhist texts, it quite often they are a little bit vague about what nibbana is about, this parinibbana. They sometimes call it a certain consciousness or something like that. And those who have been here before and follow Ajahn Brahm's teachings, he knows he doesn't like those kind of ideas and goes against them quite a bit. And here we also see very clearly what the Buddha is saying. Only bodily remains will be left of the enlightened being. All the rest has cooled off, has gone away. So I'll become peace instead. No more experiences of suffering, no more experiences at all, actually. This is what has happened to the enlightened being. And as I said before, this may be hard to see how can this be the highest happiness. Yeah. as we see in the first text, if you notice as it really is, Nibbana is the highest happiness. Can be hard to relate to this, but I like one of my favorite stories is one of these fairy tales by the Brothers Grimm that they wrote they collected all these tales that were in existence at the time, and I think Snow White is one of them, and Rapunzel, Red Riding Hood, all these that we know very well. But another one that they made, it's called Lucky Hans, or Hans in Luck. It's not the same Hans of Hans and Gretel, it's another Hans. And maybe I'll finish with that story, and I'll just leave the last sutta for you to read by yourself. And this story is about Hans, and Hans has been working very hard for many years under his master. And after all these hard years of work, he thinks, I've done enough work. It's time for me to go back home and see my mother. So he goes up to his boss and says, "Oh, boss, I'm going. Can I get my wage, for all these hard years of hard work that I've been doing?" And the boss says, "Yes, Hans, you have been working very hard, and you deserve a good wage. Here is for you a block of gold as big as your head." Wow. A block of gold like this. So Hans puts it in a bag, slings it over his shoulder, and happily walks away with his block of gold. And he lives quite far away from where he has been working, so he has a long time to travel. And he starts getting tired after walking all these days. His shoes are wearing down. And Hans thinks, all this time I'm carrying this block of gold around and it's not doing me anything good. Why do I keep carrying this around? And he meets somebody, a farmer he meets on the road, walking with a horse. And Hans walks up to him and says, you've got a horse, that's perfect. That's exactly what I need. On a horse you can sit, you don't get tired, it just walks you to your destination. How about I give you this block of gold and I take your horse? Well, says the farmer, that sounds like a good deal to me. So they exchange, and Hans, lucky Hans, or happy Hans, continues merrily on his way, now on the back of his horse. Suddenly, the horse gets scared by something on the road, and he jumps, and Hans falls off the horse, on his back. Stupid horse, thinks Hans. Why do I have this horse? This is no good for me. It just brings me more pain and suffering by throwing me off. I could have something better than this. And he meets, on the road, a lady. And this lady is walking, and she has a cow. Hans thinks, a cow, that would be really good. A cow, it doesn't throw me off. Yeah, and they're much more gentle than horses. And I can get something to drink as well. I'm getting really thirsty of all this walking around all the time. So maybe I can exchange my cow. And the lady says, what a nice horse, maybe you can exchange. And yes, of course, Hans gets the cow, and he is very happy with the cow, and he and the cow start walking. Hans in front of his cow, very happy. He's got this excellent cow. And after the end of the day walking, he gets thirsty, and he thinks, okay, now I'll get all this good milk out of this cow. He stops the cow, goes and sits underneath. But nothing comes out. The cow is totally dry. Says Hans, why does this happen to me? I wish I didn't have this cow. What good is a cow for me? And he comes up to the road, and a man is carrying a pig under his arm. And Hans walks up to him and says, you've got this beautiful pig. And Hans thinks to himself, a pig would be good. I can turn it into bacon, Yeah, it was not a very Buddhist idea, of course. Hans maybe wasn't a Buddhist, but this is what the story says anyway. I can't change the story. And this man says, "Well, yeah, you can have this this pig, if I can have your cow." So they exchange, and Hans is very happy with his pig, and it continues another day. The next day, he walks into a village, and the policeman walks up to him and says to Hans, "Well, no, actually, it wasn't a policeman. It was just a normal person." So that this person walks up to Hans and says, "I see you've got this pig, but don't you know that in the village, a pig got stolen yesterday?" "Yeah, and the police are looking for him. So I don't want to get you into trouble. How about you change this pig with my goose? I've got a goose." And Hans thinks, "Yeah, this pig will give me nothing but trouble. Why do I have this pig? I should get the goose. And the goose, at least I can make it into a pillow or something, yeah? Maybe we can use the fat for something." Again, not very Buddhist, but Hans thought that anyway. And he takes the goose. Happy again, he continues on his way. And then in the next village, he meets a man. And a man, turning a wheel, grinding knives. Yeah, how they did it in the olden days, they did it by hand. And Hans is very interested in this. He says, "What are you doing?" "Yeah, I'm grinding knives. Somebody will grind knives. Always finds a job. In every village, people have knives, and they have scissors and other tools that they need to sharpen. So as a knife grinder, I always get by, I always get money, I always get new shoes, I always get something to drink, I always get something to eat, I get nice pillows. But you have a nice pig, or a nice goose, Hans." And Hans says, "Yeah, maybe I can change this goose for this stone that the man has to grind his knives, and then I can grind knives for the rest of my life and be happy. This goose is just moving around all the place anyway. What good has it done for me? I will change it for this stone." So Hans changes the goose for the stone and he continues happily on his way again. And then the next day, Hans, thirsty, comes to a well and he wants something to drink. The well isn't very deep, so he can reach the water, but he needs to lean over a bit. So, yeah, it's a bit clumsy with the stone, so he puts the stone aside on the well, leans in to get the water, and what happens? Boom! He pushes the stone into the water, and he loses his stone, and it sinks down. And now Hans has nothing left. And then Hans suddenly realizes, "Now I am free. Now I am really lucky, Hans, to have nothing in the world. Nothing to carry. Nothing to care about. Ah, oh, this is the best." And Hans, happy, more happy than he ever was, continues on his way and meets his mother. And they live happily after. No. That is the story of Lucky Hans, and I really love that because it shows you how attachments can create so much problems. And we think we are happy by having things, by experiencing things, but you throw the stone into the well, you throw your mind out for a moment, and plunk, and then you realize, this is much better. This is what I want. This is the paramang sukhang, the highest happiness, when it all stops and there's nothing more to carry than we are lucky Hans. Thank you everybody for your attention and for being here. If there's any more questions, then please feel free to ask. As I said before, there's another text, but we don't have time for that, so maybe one day in the future I can do that one. Yeah, there may be some questions from the internet as well. I'm YouTube now. Uh-oh. This is a question all the way from Ukraine. Hello, person from Ukraine. The question is, you said that we get reborn because of desire to exist. Okay. What if I die with no desires at all in my mind, but have some karma left? How should I phrase this? Well, if you die and you have no desires left at all, then as we've seen in those suttas here before, there's no fuel left to continue this process of rebirth. So then, if you die with no desires at all, you are enlightened, and if you die then, there's nothing to keep you being reborn, so then you don't get reborn anymore. But what if you have some karma left? Karma only exists with desire, along with desire. Karma is, you could say, what shapes your next life. Desire is what pushes you on to the next life. So it doesn't happen that you can be reborn only because of karma. You have to have some desire as well to push you on to the next life. And because at the moment, an enlightened being, when they die, that is when all karma and all the results of previous karma, which is the body they still experience, when those all end at that moment. Yeah. So don't be afraid, person from Ukraine, maybe you don't have any desires, I don't know, but you won't be reborn, so don't worry if you don't have any desires. Yeah. All right, no questions anymore from here? Oh, there is one, okay.
Venerable, I'd just like to find out, what's the difference between an Arahat's enlightenment and Buddha's enlightenment? Is there any difference?
There is, according to the text, there is a difference only in the amount of wisdom and realization. They are both enlightened beings, and the Buddha are both enlightened and they won't get reborn anymore. They don't have any desires anymore. But the Buddha may have some more psychic powers, maybe some more knowledge about the Dhamma. He was a bit more, as you could say, a bit more special, because he realized the Dhamma by himself and didn't need anybody at least in this lifetime to teach him. So sometimes a person gets enlightened in this way and they have more wisdom than others. But apart from that, the Buddha and other arahants are just as free from desires. Yeah. Thank you. Again, thanks everybody for being here with me. It was a really nice opportunity to be able to share some words. Oh, there. No, you can come up also afterwards if you have some more questions. I'll hang around for a little bit. So let's pay respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha now.